Good morning, everyone. Moving forward after failures. I feel like last night after going through that activity next door and all those kings and queens in that history, I feel like this morning I need to move on after failure because I don't think I knew the answer to a single question yesterday. That was pretty sad. Our American history, we are really lacking on any of the history of what's going on in the British Commonwealth. And I had no idea that really you were also connected to that. That was a very interesting lesson for myself yesterday. I just had gotten the impression, I guess, that Australia was much more disconnected, but that was very interesting to watch. So I will try to move on today after being a total failure last night. And I'm sorry to my team that I let you down so bad. I don't think about that. I could play the chess game, that would be okay. But it's very difficult to play a chess game when you're not even sure if you get the next move. And in the end, you count up how many pieces were taken. Wow, that was very interesting. So if I ever come back again, boy, we're going to get that queen out right away, and we're just going to go after every pawn we can get. Whole new strategy for that game. Anyways, that was a lot of fun everybody had last night, and good on you, right? Good on you, mates, right? So, yes, moving on after failures. Yesterday, we ended up looking at an area that I really think in our community is one that we can, as human people, we do need to work on, is the idea of learning how to forgive other people's children. I don't think we have that much trouble with our own, but we have a lot of trouble forgiving the mistakes of other families. And that's something I've witnessed in just growing up in the truth and watching and just experiencing our community. That's an area I know myself that I can work on. Uh-oh, what do we got here? Thank you very much. See, technical difficulties. That's a good example of how we need all the different parts of the body. Everybody has a part to play in ecclesial life. Can you hear me now? Are we live? We're good. Okay, thank you. That's why I have my backup. See, that's what I do. I carry my backup with me because I can't redo a class and talk to a wall. If I can't see your faces, I'm in big trouble. That's from too many years of teaching kids, I guess. But anyways, in terms of forgiveness, I think it's something we can all stand to be reminded of when people make mistakes, and we will. We'll have family. Our family members are going to make mistakes. We ourselves are making mistakes. Sometimes those mistakes aren't as obvious, though. As you're going through Brother Brian's class, and you're going through Matthew 5 and 6, and you start looking at how Jesus went after the fact that, well, it isn't just those who commit adultery. It's all the brethren and sisters who are commit adultery in their hearts that God is after. We don't even know those cases. We only know the ones that are very public. You know, and you really can't tell what's happening in my mind, and I can't read yours. And we can be very thankful that we can't, because we'd probably be really disappointed in each other if we actually saw what was happening in our minds and what the angels have to work with. It's a very difficult thing to save any of us. And from the beginning, none of us really stand a chance from a human perspective until God selects and he picks people that he invites into his family. And he works with us and brings us through the experiences. And it really is what a wonderful God that we have, that he's willing to spend the time and the effort to save us who are so far away from him by nature and in his way of life. And you look at the reminder that we got in the Lord's Prayer of, Father, you know, we pray that you will forgive us as we have forgiven others. And you know, after the Lord's Prayer was over, did you notice that's the first thing Jesus talked about? Those are the kind of things you look for in the Scriptures. What were the key points of the Lord's Prayer? And although he praises God, he's thankful and asking for God's help, when he was all done with the Lord's Prayer, immediately he goes in and tells them, for if you forgive men their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive men their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive your trespasses. And I think that's a great warning to all of us that that's our natural tendency. Our tendency is to not want to forgive. And so we have to work on that. We have to learn to be like our God. And that's our goal this week, and that's our goal really in our lives when we're doing the readings. And it's amazing how when we do forgive people of the mistakes that they make, you can't change the past, brethren and sisters. But when we forgive family members, other family members, ecclesial members that have made mistakes, we can't change what happened in the past. We can learn from the past. But when we forgive people, we can sure change the future. What a difference it makes when you can move forward, as God allowed David to do, and move forward in ecclesial life. And in talking to some of you this morning and yesterday as well, you know, in terms of this is a broad subject, and if we had the time to break it down to all different components, you would. But I was just dealing in general yesterday with this subject. And when you're looking at some of the specific cases, we have situations that I've lived through in our family where you have problems where you know, people end up being abused and kids are taken advantage of and things happen in ecclesial life. And so when you look at all the gamut of all the mistakes that we can make, sure, we do put things into place. We do put provisions in there so that if something happens and a brother comes back to us or a sister and they ask for forgiveness, we do forgive and we try to move forward. But sometimes we do have some protective barriers in there where we don't put a brother or a sister in another situation where they're prone to do the same thing again, or everybody's at least watching a lot more carefully. And that's practical that we do that. But the key is that we still have to give people more opportunities. We have to allow for the fact that most of our community that make mistakes, when you look across our audience right here, most of us, when we make our mistakes, our goal is to learn from those mistakes and try to move forward. And what we want to look at this morning is how God let David move forward. I find that fascinating. The amazing part about David's life is that because of what David did, and because of it, you know, filtering out through the kingdom, and people would have found out of what happened, that eventually it would get passed on. They didn't all watch it on TV or see it on the Yahoo News or whatever. But eventually people found out. And look, just as you see today in situations that go on in politics today, David should have had to step down. I mean, that would be the thing that we would do. We would just immediately demand, well, if we found out about this in ecclesial life, that one of our leaders has done this, we would just think right away, you've got to step down and come and pull out. But God doesn't do that with David. That's really interesting, isn't it? That God doesn't ask David to step down. And David's probably feeling like he should. Now, if you were in his shoes, that's how we would feel. I would feel that way. You can't continue doing this. You can't keep taking a public role like this. It would be very much like, remember when Aaron, on the very first day that Aaron was supposed to operate as the priest of Israel. The very first day they built the tabernacle, they had it all going. Him and his sons had spent with Moses 7 days going through the consecration week of getting ready. And on the first day when they tried to operate as priests for God, what happened? His two boys get struck dead. And Aaron violates the rules. And Moses comes after him and he says, where's the goat of the sin offering? Where is it? Where is it? You know the rules? If its blood doesn't go into the most holy place, into immortality, then you as priests were supposed to eat the blood of the sin offering and bear the iniquity of the people. That's how God set this up. He didn't want a priest under this rule to ever be able to do both at the same time. You could do one or you could do the other. And only the Lord Jesus Christ would ever do both. And Moses looks around, where's the goat? Where's the goat? And he gets all upset at Aaron, like, what's the problem? You didn't follow the rules on the first day. And Aaron looks at Moses and he says, Moses, look what happened to my family. Look what happened. How in the world can I possibly bear the iniquity of the people when my two sons were just struck dead? And we failed. My whole family, we failed. And look at what happened. And with that, Moses listened. He listened to Aaron and he said, wow. And it made him think. He said, you know, you're right. And with that, Moses walks away. That's all there in Leviticus. And you read through Leviticus 10. It's all in there. That's the first day. I really think, you know, in terms of like looking at how angels orchestrate things, here it is on the first day that the law of Moses was supposed to operate. And the Jews would look back at that event and they would think this law is going to save us. And if they just thought about it for a moment, on the very first day it failed. It totally failed. And they should have learned from that. So, you know, what happens though is that God uses these events. And in this case, what naturally should have happened is David should have resigned. But he doesn't. And you look at how our politicians today, I know you've got some over in Australia, you've got some in Israel as well that have gone through this where they get caught up in immorality. We've certainly had some in the United States. And what most people do at that point is they lose their faith and their trust in their politician when they realize that this is the kind of lifestyle that they have. So, what does God do? Well, he takes their first child. Does that. This is what God, you sort of analyze, like, what was God willing to do? I know what we would have done. We would have stepped in today and we would have made David resign. This is what I would want to do, at least. I would say, all right, David, you should resign. There's no way you can lead the people. And really, you know, you really should split up with Bathsheba as well. Because you can't set this kind of example for the young people. You really shouldn't do this. And that's what I would want to do by nature. I would just say, this would be my way of handling the situation. But I'm fascinated at the fact that's not how the angels did this. This isn't what God did. He doesn't have David split up with Bathsheba, and he doesn't have David resign. Instead, they came up with other things to bring into David's life through his family experiences, where David was going to be reminded about his mistakes that he had made, and David was going to learn from the mistakes that he had made, and he's going to move forward. And God gives him that opportunity. So the first child is born. Then you know the story, how he pleaded with God that the first child might live. And then he hears people whispering, and he realizes, wow, he perceives it in 2 Samuel 12. Down at verse 19, he realizes that the child's dead. And so David said to his servants, "Is the child dead?" And they said, "He's dead." And David was so willing to accept what God brought into his life. You know, and you look at the account there, and they wondered, like, how can you do this? He gets up from the ground, he washes, he anoints himself in verse 20, changed his clothes, went into the house of the Lord, and he worshiped. This was the kind of man that David was. And so God responded that way and treated him like this and left him in power to rule those people. And he went to his own house, and when they requested, they set food before him, when he requested, and he ate. And they come to him, and they say in verse 22, and in verse 21 there, they wonder, like, what are you doing? How can you act like this? And he says, well, when the child was alive, I fasted and wept, for I said, who can tell whether the Lord will be gracious to me that the child may live? But now that he's dead, why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he shall not return to me. And this is the kind of man that David was. And this is what you try to read on people. You try to figure out when folks make a comeback and they're coming back to our community. This sets the example of how we should return, of how we make a comeback in ecclesial life. We don't come back on our high horse and make demands and think that I should be allowed to do this or that. You come back like David, totally trusting what God will bring into your life. And accepting the consequences of what's going to happen now because of mistakes I have made. And we watch the angels bring these things into his life. They chose to take the life of this child. And they learned from this. But they didn't make him separate from Bathsheba. I find that really interesting because that's what I would have thought naturally. That's what the road I would have gone down. And I wouldn't have left David in power either. I find that interesting that God was willing to leave him there. But what God watches, I'm sure, is he's watching David to see now how is he going to respond. And David responds in faith. And when people do that, brothers and sisters, which I really believe most of our community want to do, when our kids make mistakes and they make errors and they come back to us, and they're so embarrassed in ecclesias today and they have to come back and they're humiliated for mistakes that they've made, most of them want to find a way to make a comeback. Most of them do. And I know there's cases where that's not true and somebody comes back in like, oh, I didn't really do anything wrong. And I'm not talking about those. David clearly knew he made a mistake. He was very apologetic. But when that happens, what we have to do is treat these people like God treats them. And God is willing to let David move on. And he brings the consequences that God brings into their life. And we trust that God will do that. God will bring the right things into their life so that they'll be reminded of what they've done. They're going to learn from those mistakes, and they are going to move forward. But good old David, you can see he's the kind of man, I think most of the guys here can more identify with that. I know most of the women here, I know my wife Sue, I've talked to her about this, we finally figured there's no way Bathsheba would have responded like this. It just shows you differences between the guys and the girls. I'm sure David found it much easier, in a sense, to pray about it, talk about it to God, and when the child dies, move on. Some of our people don't move on that fast. And we have to be patient with that as well, because this is a very difficult thing for Bathsheba to accept. But God does. He allows them both to move on, doesn't split them up, and allows them to rebuild. And this is the part of ecclesial life that I really think our community could learn something from when you look at this story of David. So they try again, and David goes in, and he comforts his wife Bathsheba, and he bears a son and calls his name Solomon, peaceful, and now the Lord loved him. Isn't that fascinating that God doesn't split them up, God doesn't make them separate, and God, although he took the first child, they've learned from the experience, and this time around, the very same people that had committed this terrible error, now God blesses them with a child, and the Lord loved him. And that's what we need to practice. We need to practice being like our Heavenly Father, learning how to be a father who forgives a prodigal son and welcomes him back with open arms. And sure, God brings consequences into their life, But when he sees his children changing and learning from their experiences, he's so happy and he so wants to bless them. And he certainly does that in his case by granting them a child, and he gives them one that they call Peaceful, but and yet he calls his name Jedidiah, loved of Yah, because of the Lord. And it's a great story in terms of trying to balance us out on how do we handle people that have made mistakes and allow them to move forward. So David certainly understood the mercy of God, and I think he learned a lot from that. And what God is doing with David is that David, as a younger person, starts out on that balance of justice and mercy as the pendulum swings back and forth. And as a typical young person, he's ready to go after Nabal, and he's ready to take his vengeance. And now what God's done is just taught him through the experiences of his life to learn about the mercy of God. And David never looked back. He had learned something by experience that he could never learn by reading this book. And that's part of what the angels have to do. We do our Bible readings, and we read the stories, and we try to learn from those stories. But most of us can't learn from just reading the text. We don't get it, and so we have to experience it. The better job we do of reading the text, I think the better circumstances we're in terms of moving towards the character of God. But when we don't get an issue, the angels have to make us face it in our lives. And what better way to do that than with our families and with our experiences, with mistakes that we make like this. And so David's learning how to show mercy. And he learns it because he experienced it firsthand himself. One of the great things about David, though, is that he accepted God's will all the way through this. And I think that's one of the great lessons that all of us can learn. He was sorry. He really was sorry for the sins that he had committed, for the adultery with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah. And I know as an arranging brother, when people come back to us having made mistakes, it's very difficult for us to ascertain that perfectly. We talk to people. We try to get an understanding. I think the best thing to do is have them over to our house, get to know them as people, instead of just having meetings with them, but actually try to help them move forward so that we aren't just making a decision, but we're trying to get to know them. We want to actually get involved in their lives and help them through this rather than just making decisions about their life. That's a tough thing to do. And there are some times where we will get burned. I acknowledge that. There are times where we try our best and somebody makes a mistake and we try to welcome them back. And in turn, you know, some time goes by and they do it again. And so we learn from that. As brothers and sisters, we learn. As moms and dads, we learn that with our kids. We practice this all the time where we put in circumstances into their life and we watch to see how they will learn. Well, God's doing the same thing with David. I'm sure he's watching, and he's watching to see how David's going to respond. So God forgave David, but he brought consequences into David's life. And he brought consequences into David's life that I would not have thought of. I wouldn't have thought of how to do this. I would have made different decisions. And I've learned from this that really, I think there's many times in our lives today where we should maybe let go of some of those consequences that we think we have to bring into somebody's life and let God take care of it, because he'll do a far more effective way of bringing in the appropriate consequences than we can ourselves. We don't know the people well enough. We don't know the right thing to bring into their lives. We were talking this morning about what Joseph did with his brothers. And who would have figured all that out ahead of time? Most of us don't have the wisdom of Joseph to know how to run people through tests like that. I mean, Joseph's about as close as operating like an angel would today in our lives as any Bible character did. Because he brings circumstances and tests into those people's lives to just evaluate how they're doing. That takes a tremendous amount of wisdom. David pleaded with God for the life of his child, but as soon as the child died, he accepted God's will. That's part of what our young people are looking for in us, is acceptance of the will of God when he brings consequences. And as people who make mistakes, when God then brings consequences into our lives, we can't just try to cover it up and just say, well, that's a random event. We accept the fact that, wow, I've made mistakes. I made a ton of mistakes. And whatever God brings into my life is right. It's fair for me. God is right. We declare God right because he's right about it all, and he's trying to save us and bring us into his family. And David and Bathsheba, they're a great example of moving forward and trusting that God will allow you to move forward. And they tried again, and God totally changed it the second time around and blessed them with the birth of Solomon. I really do believe, though, that accepting God's will in our life brings us all a tremendous amount of peace. We look at the peace of God that passes all understanding. And when you let go of thinking we're in control and we start realizing God's the one in control, then, wow, I don't have to make all these decisions anymore. I don't have to figure everything out anymore. I have to make all these plans and scheme all these things so I can get to this point and this will happen in ecclesial life, because it's God's family, it's God's ecclesia, and His angels are out there, and they're going to do a far better job than I could of orchestrating all these events so that the right things will happen. One of the things about David that I found fascinating is that most brethren in his shoes, I think most of us, would probably have about given up. You know, we look at like with Peter, when he looked at the Lord and the cock crowed, and Peter realized, wow, I'd failed. And here I thought I was so strong. David probably would have thought he was so strong, the great warrior, the champion who killed Goliath. And what do you do when you fail? What happens, brethren and sisters, when we've almost like put ourselves up on a pedestal that we've created, and we think we're really better than we are, and all of a sudden we find out we're no different than our fathers and everybody else all around? We've all got the same human nature that we're dealing with. You know, you look at David's life of disappointments that he would have gone through. When the Philistine princes wouldn't allow David and his men to join them in the battle, his plan at that point had fallen apart, because that was all part of what he thought that was going to go on. You look in 1 Samuel 30, when the Amalekites raided Ziklag, and they came back after that event, and the Amalekites had burned it to the ground and taken all their families captive. I mean, all this happens in a matter of a few days. David goes up to find out if he can fight in the battle, gets turned down, comes back down, Ziklag's destroyed, burned to the ground. All the women and children have been carted off on their way. The Amalekites had taken them down towards the south. David was greatly distressed, and his men spoke of stoning him. His men, the very men that he had been with, his family in a sense to him, his ecclesia was going to stone him at that point. So David strengthens himself in the Lord his God. You know, those Psalms that we read and the meditation that David went through, trusting God to bring him through this. And he comes out stronger and he wins his men over to the fact it's going to be okay. God is going to help us. He inquires of God through Abiathar. He asks for God's help. And God says, go ahead, go after him. At that very point, that's when Saul and Jonathan, who are fighting with the Philistines, they die in battle. David's great friend Jonathan is taken from him at that point. And you know, you look back at David's family and realize that, wow, this is like one of the real low points in David's life, about as low as it can get. His friend Jonathan's been killed. Samuel's gone. You know, Saul's dead now as well. And that Israel's being destroyed. His ecclesia, he's watching the Philistines come through and just go right through the land. The ark gets taken when it goes into battle. They had to pull the tabernacle from Shiloh because the Philistines came down through the land. They invaded right through the central area. And so they carted up from Shiloh and it never went back. And that's the event, actually, where God would look back in Jeremiah and said, Jeremiah said, remember, and when Jeremiah went out and preached, and he said that God will make this house, the one in Jerusalem in his day, like Shiloh. And, you know, they go back and look at Shiloh, nothing there, where God's tabernacle had been for hundreds of years. And now it's gone. And all this is happening. And you look at David, how it could have been so easy to become so disappointed and discouraged that you would just give up. Give up. You know, what's the truth for? Everything's just falling apart. You know, it was only like a week later that he was king of Judah. I thought that's how fast God can turn events around in your life. He trusted God. God worked through this. The angels orchestrated events at this time. He takes over the Amalekites, wins back all his family, comes back into the land. Saul is gone, and the men of Judah accept David as their king. It's fascinating to watch how God can so easily turn about the events of our life. Look at the disappointment that David had to deal with Saul. You know, that Saul was so jealous and angry of David earlier on in 1 Samuel 18, all the attempts that he made to kill him. Saul's attempts that he made to separate David and Jonathan. You know, you could see that. And when Saul's, you know, you've chosen this man to your own shame. And he tried to drive a wedge in between the friendship that Saul, that David and Jonathan had had. Imagine David growing up being anointed as the king. And he would have dreamed of the day and think, well, God has in store for me. I'm going to be living at the palace. I'm going to be there with Jonathan, my close friend, and we're going to have great times together. And he dreamed almost like in a Cinderella way of what life was going to be like, you know, in the days to come. And he's going to go out there and fight the battles of the Lord. But instead, as you watch his life play out, he had to deal with disappointment after disappointment in his family and his ecclesia. As he's fleeing the country and goes over to the Philistines because he's rejected. But what David does is he patiently waits for God to resolve the situation. He doesn't force it. He follows through, looking for guidance, trying to figure out what God's doing. Later on, you find in David's life, he finally gets as king of the nation. And he's dreamed about the day. He's been trying to figure out, where's the place? Where's the place where God had just said he was going to meet? And he's trying to figure it out. He's trying to determine, where is it going to be? And he's got ideas in his mind. And he actually comes to a point where you think he's almost got it figured out that it's going to be somewhere around Mount Moriah. And then the incident that we never got to on when kings make mistakes, the next one that we would have looked at was when he numbered the people. And from that mistake of numbering the people, when the angel was standing there with his sword ready to go after Jerusalem, and he buys the threshing floor and he offers up the sacrifices, the very next event is that David says, all right, now I know where God wants his temple. And this is the kind of man he was. He's putting pieces together, watching events of his life, even his mistakes, trying to piece things together and learn from them as to what God's trying to tell him in his life. And it's a great pattern to look back at as to how God works in our lives today. And so Nathan finally comes to David after he's all set up and he's established the ark. He's set up the tabernacle of David in Jerusalem in 1 Chronicles 16. And he's so sure that now the next thing we're going to do is build God a house. And he wants to build God's house. And Nathan informs him in 1 Chronicles 17. He said, look, God doesn't want you to build the house. And if that had been you, or that had been me, I know I would have been so disappointed at that point for an ecclesial project or something I had hoped to do. I'd been thinking about for years, and it looks like we can finally do it. And then God tells me and says, look, you're not the one to do it. It could be very easy to get discouraged at that point and just think, well, you know, God doesn't want me to do it. He doesn't trust me to do it. I know the mistakes I've made in the past, and he doesn't want me to do this. And you could become discouraged in ecclesial life. And then sort of what happens over time is when those discouragements mount up, when things go wrong in our families and our ecclesias and our health and all this happens, and you know this, as older brothers and sisters, we've built up things like this, that we've accumulated things over time. What happens is we can easily slack off in our interest and our service of God. David doesn't do that. He's a great example of living through disappointments and moving on. He just continues to get involved in more things. And his response to that, well, if God won't let me build the temple and Solomon's going to build it, then I'll do everything I can ahead of time to make it so that Solomon can put it up real quick. And it'll get done. And he makes all the preparations that he can for the building of the temple ahead of time. He sets up all the organization of the temple. You look in 1 Chronicles 22, that whole section that starts in there, how he continued preparing for the building of the temple. And he organized the Levites and the priests and the musicians and the gatekeepers. He did all the organizational stuff and got all the supplies ready so that when it came time, then Solomon could build the house. What a great example, though, brethren and sisters, for all of us, that when we have aspirations in ecclesial life, or we have a project that we want to do, or whether it's something, or we're trying to talk to our kids who maybe feel this way about what they want to do in ecclesial life, and then they find out, well, the ecclesia doesn't select them to run that project. They haven't been picked. Or maybe they don't want them to run that project. It would be very easy for our kids and for other young people at that point to become so discouraged that they just decide, well, I don't know if I want to work in this ecclesia anymore. Because there are plenty of things that go wrong in ecclesial life that it's very easy to turn our folks off from working in the ecclesia. And what we have to do is remind them about David. God didn't let David build a house. He didn't let him do it. But David didn't stop there and just say, all right, it's not my job. I'm going to walk away from it and I'm not going to be involved. He still did everything he could to help the project, as much as he could do, and more than I think most of us could ever imagine, because he accepted God's will. He accepted God's working in his life and realized, well, if this is what God wants, I'll just do the part I can, and God, and we'll just help the project go along. Look at the disappointments that David had in his own family. You know, you can start mounting them up where the baby dies in 2 Samuel 12. Ammon's forced Tamar later on, and he hears about it in 2 Samuel 13. Absalom's killed by Amnon later on in 2 Samuel 13. Hey, look, all these things are just piling up one after the next. Absalom fled to Geshur at that point. And Absalom's treason later on with David, and when he flees in 2 Samuel 15. And finally, Absalom's death. David looked at all those events, and he realized that this is what God had brought into his life. That God was allowing these things to happen because of mistakes David made. And it's not that God made Absalom be the kind of person he is. He simply used him. He used Absalom. He used David's family in order to teach lessons that were huge. And David's learning how to trust God and how to show mercy to people that really didn't deserve mercy any more than David deserved it himself. And he feels responsible because God had said, I will raise up adversity against you from your own house. And now he had to live with that. But can you imagine, brothers and sisters, we would have never figured out that that was the right way to get to David. We would have come up, I know I would, with all kinds of other things to do with David in his life, with Bathsheba or something, or pulling him out of the kingdom. But instead, God picks to work through adversity in his house because he knows this is what's going to really get at David and help him to learn. You know, and you know, go back and look at that. You know, sometimes in Hebrews 12, we know how God says, Paul says at that point, that, you know, after all that Christ went through, and God's goal in Hebrews 11 is that we will develop the faith that saves, the faith that pleases God, and mentions Jesus Christ, the author and the perfecter of faith in Hebrews chapter 12, and then deals with the fact that, yes, we are going to experience troubles. We're going to experience problems. I was looking the other night when John was going through his class on the thorn of crowns. You know that word for scourging doesn't occur very often in the New Testament, but you know that word is in Hebrews 12, that God chastens and scourges every son of his. We are going to go through some tough times, but he doesn't do it to punish us, Paul says. He doesn't bring these things into David's life to punish him. That's what I would do. I would want to punish David for what he did wrong. And this is where we run into all kinds of mistakes in how we handle our children and our ecclesial members. We think we have to punish them for their mistakes. You know, God doesn't ever punish you for your mistakes unless you're not one of his family. That's why in the Bible they very carefully chose the word chastening. Chasten. Paul uses that in Hebrews chapter 12. He says God chastens every son of his. And as parents, those of you raising children, it's such a great lesson to learn that when we chasten our children, we don't punish them. We don't put them into situations where I'm punishing you for mistakes that you've made. That isn't how God treats us. He chastens us. If you ever check out that word coming from the Old Testament, what it means, it doesn't mean punish, it means instruct. Instruct. It's all about a teaching mechanism. God's doing all these things to save us. And as parents, we have to communicate that to our children, to our grandchildren, to people in our ecclesial life who make mistakes. We don't punish our brethren and sisters. That's not our role. God will punish the wicked in the end. What we do is we chasten. We discipline them so that it's an instructive process. We have to try to pick the most appropriate thing that we can figure out for their discipline. That was always the great challenge of every teacher when you walk into a classroom. Those of you that have taught public school, you know this. You have to immediately have to look across your audience, get to know your kids really well, and then as soon as Johnny does something over there and then messes up, you have to find out what's the appropriate thing for him to learn the lesson. That's one of the greatest challenges that you have in ecclesial life, as well as arranging brethren or as parents. Those of you that have raised a lot of children, you'll know this is true, that, you know, when raising six kids, we found that what might work with one child doesn't work with another one. And so you get to know your kids, you have to know them well, so that when they make mistakes, we pick an appropriate thing for them to chasten them, to instruct them that they may learn. And this is exactly what God is doing with David. And that's where you start to learn that, well, you don't have to bring the same thing on every child who makes a mistake. I wouldn't do that in school either, because different kids need different things. And in our life, that's what it's like as parents. We bring an appropriate thing into the life of one child that may be different than what we do with another child. And so as brethren and sisters, when we watch then what angels do to us, don't be surprised when angels bring events into your life that are different than what they bring into my life, because they know what you need. And so this is what God does. He gives every one of us the appropriate chastening, the appropriate events in our life that we need to develop into his family. And then as parents, we learn, well, if that's what he does with us, then that's what I need to do with my own children. And then when we learn that in our own families, as we're going to look at tonight in the class on families, is that then you realize, well, if that's what works in my family, then what God wants me to do is do the same thing in the ecclesia. Is get to know everybody like that so that you can bring the appropriate things onto people who have made mistakes and learn how to treat them like family members. So when we're dealing with those disappointments in life, let's be careful, because we have to respond appropriately. When God brings things into our life, We don't tell our kids, that's not fair, this shouldn't be happening to me, or I don't know what God is doing. We try to communicate to our children, well, I may not understand right now, but I totally trust God knows what he's doing. And I understand that. And someday we'll be able to look back at this and realize why this has happened. But what he's doing right now is right for us. It's right. We declare God right to our kids. And they totally learn to trust whatever God does. And this is what we want to communicate. This is actually far more important than the doctrines that we teach. And we're so big on our first principles, and we want to get those first principles across. But what God wants, or what you look what Jesus is doing in Matthew 5 and 6 and 7, he's communicating a way of life where you trust a father and you attempt to mimic a father. So you learn about your father's character, and then you try to mimic that in your life. This is part of living as God's family. And what you do is you learn to trust God. You look back at some Bible characters who didn't do that, and you look at the case of like Lot. I think a lot of us, if we were reading about Lot in the Old Testament, we would just write him off and say, well, forget him. There's no way he'll be in the kingdom because of all of Lot's mistakes. This is our natural mind looking at somebody's life. We evaluate all their mistakes. We judge them, and we just say, well, there's no way. He never learned. But that's not what Peter says. So Peter makes us have another look. But the mistake that Lot made, when you look back at him, is he let his mistakes, he let them spiral into a kind of depression where he couldn't get out of it. And so he goes from one stage of being disappointment to another stage to another stage to where he finally works himself into isolation. When you look back at Lot, you'd wonder, like, when he made those mistakes and ends up then with his two daughters and goes up and they come pregnant by him, and you wonder, like, how did that ever happen? You think, like, why didn't he go back to Abraham? Why not? Abraham would have welcomed him back. And Abraham would have been so glad to see him. This is the Abraham who's discussing with the angel, what if there's 40? What if there's 30? What if there's 20? And he's so convinced when he gets down to 10, he was probably sure when he went to bed that there's no way the angels would destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot had somewhere to go. He had an ecclesia he could go back to. But our brothers and sisters who become this depressed over mistakes that they have made, they feel like, I'll never be forgiven. I'll never be accepted back. They get very discouraged because they've seen this happen in our community. And they're afraid to come back. They're afraid to walk back and come back to Abraham and say, I need some help. And what we have to do, brethren and sisters, is as arranging brethren, as pastoral people, as ecclesial members, we have to reach out to those people. We have to make friends with them, invite them over, reach out and welcome them back and try to rebuild their lives. Because you can see in a case of a righteous man who's vexed in his righteous soul, his tendency was to just walk away into isolation because he just thinks there's no way to get back. I've made so many mistakes, made so many bad choices. Who's going to ever want me back? Look at, watch Naomi when she walks back in. Call me Mara. This is how people feel when they're coming back to our community, which is why we have to be very careful as to how we deal with them. That's why after dealing with the fruits of the Spirit, I don't know whether you've ever noticed before in Galatians 5, but after Paul deals with the fruits of the Spirit, you know what the very next thing he does in chapter 6? He talks about how to welcome people back who have made mistakes. And he lays the basis with the fruit of the Spirit and says, this is what you've got to learn to do. This is the fruit of the Spirit. And now when you go to help somebody come back, exhibit the fruits of the Spirit. And remember, don't think you're better than them because you could very easily fall. And God may be watching to see how you handle it when you bring them back. It's a fascinating section there. We emphasize the fruits of the Spirit, but a lot of times we don't ever look at what Galatians 5 and 6 are really dealing with in context. So what David does at this point, you watch how the angels must have been so excited because this man changed. He becomes a changed person, which is what God was really after all along. Before you see his reaction with Nabal that we looked at earlier this week, then the adultery that he has with Bathsheba, Nathan had brought him to the point where he says that the man that has done this will surely die, and he makes his judgment, this was David. This was what obviously, and then he has to listen in Psalm 51. He has to listen to Nathan saying, well, the Lord has put away your sin and you won't die. But then when you're reading through Psalm 32, and you're reading through Psalm 34, you're reading through Psalm 51, you realize this man had gone so low that now he's starting a comeback. And what he does in his comeback is he becomes a totally different person about appreciating the mercy of God. This really is what God had hoped would happen by doing the sacrifices. You ever wondered why, you know, they would say that God desires mercy and not sacrifice? You know, and we read that all the time. What's the connection? What's the connection? If you brought an animal day after day, and you identified with that animal, and you realized that's the Lord Jesus Christ, this is my goal, to be like Him. This is the Messiah, and I want to be identified with Him and found in Him. And then you realize yourself, you tell God, look at all the mistakes I've made this week. I haven't reached up to this. I haven't lived up to this perfect Lamb of God. But I'm reminded week after week with these sacrifices, and then you kill the animal, and you commit to die with Christ. And then what you do is you appeal to God, please forgive me of my mistakes. And that's why God would say, you were supposed to learn from that how to show mercy to other people. That's what it was all about. It wasn't about the sacrifice. It was about learning to extend mercy, that God desired mercy. And in the same way He will show us mercy, He was hoping we would extend that to other people. It's like it should have been obvious, wasn't it? Because you lived through it. You asked for mercy. You knew you needed it. Well, why wouldn't you be willing to show that to others? And that's what He had hoped would happen. But you could see what the Jews did with it. They just offered the sacrifice in a ritualistic way, much the same as we could with the bread and the wine. We could do the same thing. And fail to realize that that's what God is trying to teach us about learning about His mercy so that we extend it to others. So you watch now how David reacts. Now in 2 Samuel 13, he gets angry at Amnon, but he doesn't jump on Amnon's case. Oh no, God's brought this into David's family, and now he's learning how to handle this a different way. Look at David's mercy that he shows to Absalom after he kills Amnon in 2 Samuel 14. He doesn't go out and kill him right away, even though that was premeditated murder. He had set that up and come up with a plan for years to work that out. Look how David flees Jerusalem during Absalom's treason, and he just walks away instead of fighting. And David's reaction later on to Shimei, that the Lord has said to him, curse David. You know, it's fascinating, brethren, you look at the first few up there, you notice how most of those are in David's family? See what angels do in our lives? When we swing the pendulum of where we stand on judgment and mercy, and we're one of the people who tends to be over on the mercy, on the side of judgmental, what God will do, what the angels do in their kindness, is they bring events into our families where we have to watch it happen in our family. And then, because of that natural bias that we have towards our family, we learn to show mercy. And what he's hoping is that when we do it with our children and our grandchildren and our family relatives, and we learn how this works, he's hoping that then we will extend that out to the rest of God's family. It's a great plan when you look at his design. But the angels are the ones that have to do that. They have to bring those events to help us see those issues that we can't see. And they certainly did this with David as they taught him through his family. And then he learned how to extend mercy to Shimei. He learned the concept that maybe God has sent Shimei to curse. So we're not going to kill him right now. You look at the reaction to Absalom's death later on, and you see the same kind of thing. He doesn't jump on people anymore and just say, well, that man should die. He's extremely merciful. And even at the end of David's life, you see the mercy that he extended to Shimei and then to Joab, and left it in the hands of Solomon to take care of it. So God does work on our weaknesses. He looks at things that we need to learn. He works on those weaknesses if we let him. And then he lets us move on. You see, this is what he's doing with our mistakes. If we let each other move on like this, and we trust God and his angels to bring the right circumstances into people's lives, that they will learn those lessons, that it takes a lot of the pressure off of us to always think that we have to teach the lessons. We have to come up with the right consequences. And we do. We do things where we protect people. We do. But we don't always have to figure out all the right answers, all the right consequences, to the point that we sort of suppress people who have made mistakes, to the point that they can never make a comeback in ecclesial life. And they walk away like Lot and just figure, my life's over, in the truth. Nobody really wants me back. And that is the tendency of many of our folks. Not all of them, but many of our real, humble, sincere people who have made mistakes. They find it very difficult to ever make this kind of comeback. So we trust God to work in their lives. God will bring the right circumstances to teach them. He'll bring the right things that they need to learn those lessons, and he'll remind them of the mistakes of the past. But he's not going to punish us for those things. He's going to teach us, instruct us through chastening, so that we will learn from those things and move forward. You look at how David felt so responsible for these things. He wasn't the kind of person to just put the past behind him and just forgot it. He continuously felt responsible for the death of the priests over at Nob. He knew that he had actually caused that event. For the destruction of Ziklag, forever he would remember like what had happened when he went up there and got with the Philistines. For the death of Uzzah, his initial reaction is that, you know, he's angry at God. And then he would have realized that, wow, you know, I didn't do it right. And he goes back, he does his homework, he reads the scriptures and finds out the right way to do it. You know, David would have looked back at that and realized, wow, I messed up. And Uzzah died. We did it the wrong way. The death of Uriah, there was no getting around that. That was premeditated murder. Bathsheba's baby dying. You know, some of our sisters in the truth, when they lose a young baby like that, some of our sisters don't get over that for years. Years. And sometimes it's not even when the baby dies. Sometimes it's just they lose a child in utero. And then it's just a spontaneous abortion. And yet, you know, as brethren, we can just say, well, read the scriptures, read the Psalms, trust God, and get over it. That isn't how it works with all of our sisters. It's very difficult sometimes to work through that. When you talk with people and get to know them, that they find it very hard. They look back at events and think something went wrong. God did something. And David would have looked back at that and realized that, you know, his mistake in this case of taking Bathsheba had caused the death of that child. For Absalom's rebellion later on, David just felt so responsible for that. You know, oh, Absalom, my son. And realized that he had been the one who had started all this trouble. And for the death of Absalom, for all his family troubles, the census and the plague that we never really got to, the census and the plague is another one you could add into the class of kings make mistakes, because David felt responsible from that. But he learned. And as leaders in ecclesias, as moms and dads in families, we have to accept responsibility for our mistakes. It's okay to tell our kids, we made mistakes. I goofed. You know, I sinned. I made a mistake. It wasn't a good choice. And admit it. Our kids are listening for that because they know we made mistakes. They're just waiting to see, are we willing to admit it or are we going to be a hypocrite and just pretend that it didn't happen? They like to hear that, and they like to learn then, well, how do you work through that? How do you work through a mistake? So a mom and a dad are having trouble. And sure, you may hide it from younger kids, but you can't hide it from the older kids. So it's okay to talk about them, of how what you're doing and how you're trying to work through it. And you seek their help. We can use some help getting through this. And as parents and grandparents, that's what we do. We come in to help. And we look back and say, well, I can remember when this happened in my life and we made this mistake and this bad choice. And here is how we tried to work through this. And in the end, God blessed that pathway. May not have been the best pathway, but God did bless it in the end and was able to help us get through it. So, yeah, David could have easily given up, brethren and sisters. And I think that's really my message this morning to most of us, is that when mistakes happen, I think most of our community would like to give up. I think a lot of us are more like Lot than we are like somebody who just wants to come in and pretend like nothing happened. Our people that are serious and humble, they come in feeling like second-class citizens for the rest of their life. And we have to welcome them like the father did with the prodigal son and give them more opportunities to move on. David's best friend, his advisor, Jonathan, was dead. Samuel, his counselor, was dead. David made all these mistakes and cost so many people. And he had failed as a father when you look back at his life and raising his sons and what he had tried to do. You know, if God had told us about our family that adversity is going to rise up within our family, we would have probably made every effort to make sure that didn't happen. And David looked back and realized he had made a lot of failures in this. And he failed as his leadership role as the king of Israel. Here are people who were counting on him. Kids looked up to him as their hero. And he had failed his God. Against you only have I sinned. And it bothered him forever that this is what he had done. He never forgot those things. But the good thing is that he moved forward, brethren and sisters, in confidence in his God, as he did all through his life, because God let him move forward. And I think that's my major lesson today for all of us to take back home to our families and our ecclesias. That in the same way we would let my child move forward after a mistake he might make, let's learn to let someone else's child move forward. Let's extend that to our whole ecclesia and let people move forward. Let them have responsibilities in the ecclesia that we can afford to do. Maybe not necessarily what they did before, but welcome them in to be a part of our ecclesia. Get them over to our homes. Get to know them as people and help them work through those problems. Because that's what God did for David. And David, because of that, he just kept moving on. And that's a fun thing to see about David's life. So maybe we can learn to practice those very same things. Because our kids need some help in those areas. So this morning, let's make sure that, like David, we accept God's will in everything. Because everything, that is. There's no time and chance, really, when you look at that in terms of our lives today. God's in control of it all. And if we get a chance, we'll look at Ecclesiastes 9, maybe in the last class on Friday. But God is in control. The very first verse of that chapter says that God is in control of everything. So we accept God's will. God knows what he's doing, and we move on in faith. This is how David approached his relationship with God. Let's realize there's going to be disappointments in our life, and that God uses those for good, because he's training us to be in his family. And let's move forward knowing that God's in control and can use even bad events, even mistakes like this. The event with Bathsheba, as a mistake as it was, God used that to develop David's character. And he does the very same thing with us, with our kids, with our other ecclesial members. He's going to use those things for good. And we want to be a willing shepherd like David was of our flock. And let's help prepare for the future like David did. David didn't just turn his back on God when he found out he couldn't build that temple, but he decided he would do what he could. And the best thing we all can do, brothers and sisters, is that we may not be right now have the strength to be great workers in ecclesial life and get out there and do all those active jobs. But, you know, we can prepare our kids for the future. We can work with our children, with our grandchildren, some of you with your great-grandchildren, and you can help prepare for the future of ecclesial life, raising godly children and teaching them about our God and about the character of our God and about how he deals with us as his family members and how much he loves all of us and wants us to learn to live like him so that we can join him forever.